there has to be a huge shift, especially in the people who hold high positions in these corporations. There needs to be a huge shift, a huge mindset shift as well, to allow for local and smaller conservation organizations to be able to work properly so that they can include more people in their work, as well as actually meet conservation goals. But yeah, another solution that I can think of is that us as people locally, we need to support each other more often, because I feel like then it diminishes our dependence on larger corporations. The more local support you get, a lot of times is a good boost to continue doing the work that we're doing without necessarily compromising either the planet or excluding people in the projects that we have.
Hello and welcome to Earthcast, a platform for discussions about bridging the resource gap between people and planet. I am your host, Olivia Taylor, or Olivia Earth on the socials. I will be interviewing a series of change makers, thinkers, and disruptors, and asking them about their fields of interest. Together, we will discover fresh perspectives and the most useful levers in society for change. More specifically, we will look at how to solve wicked problems and make decisions at the margin. If you would like to hear more from Earthcast, click subscribe and follow us on social media. Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Earthcast. Today we are speaking to Jamila Janna, and we have been talking about doing an episode for ages, so I'm very excited to finally have you join me. I messaged Jamila after first watching her film Sulega, which is a marine conservation documentary that aims to encourage community engagement in decision-making. However, Jamila is many things. She is a poet, marine biologist, explorer, master's candidate, and a change maker. Miss Janna has a background in stable isotopes, estuarine and coastal ecology, filmmaking, science communication, and marine activism. She has participated in stakeholder engagements and public speaking. Jamila has a passion for advocating for sustainable usage, fighting environmental racism, and sharing intersectionality narratives about marine environmentalism. So a huge thank you for joining me today, and I so appreciate your time. Please may you highlight the nuances of environmental racism and how it affects marine environmentalism. You know, perhaps a bit deeper, what is the intersection between environmental racism and inclusivity in the ocean space?
Thank you so much for having me, Olivia, on Earthcast. I'm very excited to be part of this interview and actually just talk about my story and my experiences in the marine space. So to answer the first question, environmental racism in a nutshell is basically the rules, regulations, policies that governments and corporations set that actually target certain communities to live in undesirable areas. So close to landfill sites or close to mines. And a lot of times the impact that these spaces have on the communities are negative. The communities end up having health issues or just bad environmental conditions are born from those environments. And we can see that as land issues relate to people, it's mostly common in areas where there are people of color. And you do not find these issues in white communities. And you can also see this parallel in the ocean space. So South Africa's Group Areas Act in the apartheid era, a lot of communities in coastal areas had marine protected areas built adjacent to the communities, and the communities were excluded. So they had all these customary practices and traditional practices of harvesting and using the ocean resources, and then they were excluded from accessing the ocean at that point, which then resulted in communities not having the best standard of living. And there was more poverty in this community just because there was no proper consultation and these communities were not included in decision making. So there is a huge overlap between environmental racism and inclusivity. We unfortunately, and the reality is, we do live in a white male world. And when it comes to conservation issues, even land and space issues, it is a lot of times because we are trying to fulfill the vision of the founding fathers of conservation and the founding fathers of how land should be used. But we do live in Africa, and it is South Africa. And it is not just a white male country or a continent. We have people of color who need to be included in decision making as well. So when it comes to environmental racism and inclusivity, the intersection between these two is huge, it is big. And the reality is we can do so much more to try and address the gaps in inclusivity in the ocean space.
In your current work, what trade-offs are you noticing between people, planet, and profit? And recently, have you heard any compelling solutions to counter these trade-offs?
Ooh, the trade-offs between people, planet, and profit, they are so evident in the conservation space especially. There is a hierarchy. And as I said initially, we do live in a white male world. And when it comes to pursuing ventures and projects that are to protect and conserve our planet, that is how we look at things. We look at them from a white male perspective. So there are so many trade-offs. If you think about the funders who fund conservation projects, and you look at who they are and what kind of ventures that they are into, you'll find that those ventures actually are the very ones that compromise the planet. So you have a conservation organization that is all for the planet, is all for conserving and protecting our natural resources, but the money that they get are from people who are actually destroying the planet. And then you find that when it comes to the deliverables and goals that need to be met by organizations in the conservation space who get their funding from bigger corporates, you find that a lot of times the goals do exclude people. So when it comes to profit and planet, sometimes they can work together, but a lot of times people are excluded. And this is very problematic, actually, because we are, as humans, Homo sapiens, we have the biggest impact on the planet. And excluding people from the conversation is detrimental, number one, but also it allows us not to meet our conservation goals. But then on the other hand, you find that when people are included in conservation projects where there is proper consultation, where people are prioritized and their needs are met and included in decision-making, then you find that it's very hard to get funders. It's very hard to get the money aspect of it because it doesn't necessarily meet the white male conservation goals that a lot of funders outside, especially outside of South Africa, have. So it is evident, and the more you look at organizations, who their funders are, you kind of also see their goals as well and why sometimes they might exclude people more, or sometimes why they might include people in their projects. So when it comes to solutions to counter these trade-offs, it's very difficult, in my opinion, because at the end of the day, in South Africa, small conservation organizations cannot get proper funding from our own government. So we rely on outside funders, we rely on international corporates to fund local conservation efforts. And then the question is, are we going to continue having these projects with little funding, because that could actually lead to the projects themselves failing, or do we get funding from these large corporations whose goals and vision and deliverables do not necessarily sit well with us, but we need the money because we need to get this conservation work done. So it's more or less something that really needs to happen is we need more Africans, more African countries banding together to try and fund these projects. But then again, it gets difficult because as a continent, we don't have that much money. We don't have that much access to certain things. So then you start to ask the question, is it possible for these larger corporations to change how they view things and some of the deliverables that they require from small organizations that they give their funding to? And honestly, I feel like that's not possible right now. There has to be a huge shift, especially in the people who hold high positions in these corporations. There needs to be a huge shift, a huge mindset shift as well, to allow for local and smaller conservation organizations to be able to work properly so that they can include more people in their work, as well as actually meet conservation goals. Another solution that I can think of is that us as people locally, we need to support each other more often, because I feel like then it diminishes our dependence on larger corporations. The more local support you get, a lot of times is a good boost to continue doing the work that we're doing without necessarily compromising either the planet or excluding people in the projects that we have.
So further, how would you like to see youth participating in this space? You know, is there enough incentive for young people to go into conservation as a broad field?
Ooh, this is a very interesting question, and I love it because I would like to see youth participating in this space. I don't necessarily want to see any change because youth are already participating in this space. There are so many youth advocating, working so hard towards pushing the message for ocean conservation, marine protection, and sustainable resource use. And we have such amazing representatives, people who represent South Africa and Africa as a continent in global meetings on how we can protect our oceans. Conventions such as the Convention on Biological Diversity, or they are also representatives in IUCN or other panels as well. So youth are already doing the work. But for me, the thing I would like to see change is how, as a country, we approach marine sciences, especially in marine conservation. So the grievance that I have when I was in my honors and in my undergrad getting my marine biology degree was that we were learning so much about how other countries were progressing in the conservation space, but very little was being taught about how South Africa is progressing. But other than that, very little was being taught about how we have traditional knowledge systems, how there are customary rights that are tied to the ocean, how certain communities use the ocean for spiritual and cultural purposes. And it created such a huge disconnect, especially for me as a Black South African who did not go to the ocean that much, who did not know how to scuba dive or did not know how to snorkel, you know. So it felt so far for me why marine conservation mattered. And then when I started learning about marine conservation in South Africa in the form of MPAs, I was in my honors year, and it was like probably like mid-year in my honors year. And at that point, I was shocked. I remember our lecturer asking us, how many of us know which is the largest MPA in South Africa? And there was only one lady in our class, a class of, I think, 20, oh, that's a lie, it's not 20, of like 12 students. Only one could answer that question. And the only reason she could answer that question is she was working in that marine protected area. All of us had blank faces. And that is so sad that it only in our honors year did we learn about marine protected areas. But prior to that, we did not know about our marine protected areas. So there needs to be a shift in the curriculum and in how marine biology is being taught to reflect the audience who are South African youth. And it also needs to start creating a connection in the youth on why they need to protect these resources. It needs to hit home because learning about Australia, learning about the UK and how they protect is fun. And it's great to know that they are successful, but what is South Africa doing? And I feel like that's actually a form of incentive because when you start creating a connection, especially early on, especially in the education system, you can start creating more passion, deep-rooted passion, and you can have youth who are very solution-oriented. The youth that I know of who are solution-oriented and have passion have been in the game for such a long time, 12 to 15 years, and they have grown and learned in that space. But to only learn about conservation when you are 20 years old, 23 years old, 25 years old, and to try and create that passion, it becomes very difficult. And also knowing how hard it is, especially for people of color in the conservation space, how hard it is to get opportunities, how hard it is to be recognized for the work that you're doing, or even how hard it is to be employed as a full-time staff in organizations that do conservation work. You realize that it's everything works against us. So it becomes a very tiring and exhaustive to put in all that work and have all the passion with so little benefits and returns. So while there are youth participating in the space, and I love that because this is our planet, these are our oceans, and we are going to be inheriting them, and we cannot inherit a dirty, over-exploited, under-resourced oceans. We need to inherit healthy oceans. However, we need to have a greater connection in the work we're doing from early on in our education system, even if it's in high school as well, because I think that creates so much more passion, but also it means that more youth can see a future full of solutions rather than a future full of problems. And and also another major thing is that we just need to have more access for people of color in the ocean space. You know, unfortunately, with the impact apartheid had on many communities, a lot of people of color, a lot of communities of people of color, they're already so far behind. No one has the luxury of taking their children snorkeling or taking their children scuba diving at a young age because they need to put bread on the table. They need to pay rent. So to have these opportunities open for youth as they graduate out of university or as they graduate from high school is a great incentive to have more youth stay in the space because we have youth in the space, but we need more youth to stay.
So would you mind if we get into a topic that I know you're passionate about? Would you mind explaining the harmful effects of mainstream conservation narratives on environmental projects' success?
I really love this question because the issue of mainstream conservation narratives on environmental success is so rooted also in environmental racism and inclusivity in the ocean space. So I want to make this example of how, again, we live in a white male-dominated world, and the conservation efforts and the conservation narratives that have been preached globally have been from that mindset, which basically is a mindset that you conserve, you ocean grab, you land grab, and you don't look at people and how they are impacted by those conservation efforts. So mainstream conservation, in a nutshell, is you have ocean that needs protection, you protect it. You want 30% by 2030, we need to get that. Forget the humans who are involved, forget the livelihoods and the lives that are involved and will be impacted by those decisions. And that's mainstream conservation narratives. So it is very detrimental and very harmful to have this mindset, especially in a continent such as Africa, and especially in a country such as South Africa. We have many, many communities who directly rely on natural resources, on the ocean, on the land, for livelihood purposes. We see, for example, in Mozambique, just recently, they proclaimed 11 locally managed marine areas. And those marine areas are actually managed by the community themselves because the community relies on the ocean, on those mangroves, on those estuaries, and they would like to protect them. But mainstream conservation efforts do not look at it like that. So in that community, if a marine protected area was implemented instead of LMNAAs, the community would have been excluded. And once the community is excluded, then you have issues, as you see in South Africa, of poachers, people going illegally and getting those resources to sustain their livelihoods. Now, how that has an impact on environmental projects is that many of environmental projects all have the same goal, basically, to protect as much as we can so that the next generations can benefit from the environment. And if that is the main goal, we need to have very diverse ways of dealing with conservation. And some goals could be mainstream, where you land grab or ocean grab and protect as much as we can, but other solutions could be that you have more communities involved in conservation. And that is not a mainstream way of doing things. It's not a mainstream narrative, conservation narrative. But we need more of convivial, that's what it's called, convivial conservation, which is basically including more communities, having better decision-making and better consultation so that we can meet our environmental project goals. And you find that if you do not consult with communities, for example, in South Africa, you decide that you want to open up a conservation project in a community, and that community relies directly on their estuary and their rocky shores to harvest mussels and other resources. You open up your conservation project, and you go to the community and then you tell them, hey, we see that you are unsustainably harvesting mussels here and other resources. We don't want you to do this anymore because you are decreasing mussel population. And then in 10 years time, your kids will not be able to harvest these mussels, and then you're going to go hungry. And the community says, but we've been doing this for years. Who are you to come in and tell us what to do? But somehow you win and you get to enforce these laws. What then happens is while you are trying to conserve the space using your mainstream conservation narrative, which is protect, forget to exclude the communities, forget to include the communities in the decision-making process, then you have an issue 2 years down the line. There's poaching that starts. The community is hungry. You never consulted them. So it is then important to change how you do that, how you come up with these projects. If you are going to work in a community, be sure to have representatives from that community. Be sure that you understand the local community. You understand how resources are used. You understand the culture as well, and include that in your environmental plans. And it allows us then to meet more of our conservation and environmental goals and have more successful environmental projects, because we're no more doing things as the Americans are doing it or as the Europeans are doing it, but we're doing it adapted to the community that we are going to be working with. So it is very important to have non-mainstream conservation narratives, and it's very important to put them at the forefront of conservation efforts. We live in a global world, but in that global world where we're all connected by social media, we can travel less than 2 hours from Durban to Cape Town. That's how connected we all are. However, each area has its own culture. It has its own way of doing things. And we cannot treat every area homogeneously. It's not the same. There's different cultures, and those need to be included in conservation efforts. And while it may not be something that is popular on Instagram, it does help us meet our conservation goals at the end of the day. And those goals are to ensure that we sustainably use our resources, and we also protect nature itself, because it is literally what's keeping us alive. And also it will be what keeps the next generation thriving and alive as well.
Philosophically or practically, what environmental issues are you currently grappling with, and how do you want to see them or it solved?
Oh, so for me, biggest environmental issue is, as I mentioned in the previous answer, is just stakeholder engagement. While it's not necessarily something that impacts the environment, but the cascading and domino effect of excluding stakeholders is seen in the environment. So we can bring up issues of poaching, we can bring up issues of illegal activity in conservation sites and how humans are such a threat. But if we have plans that are facilitated and more inclusive, then some of these issues might start dying out. We also have, you know, we have this conversation about how plastic pollution is so bad, especially in rural communities. And then when you look back and you take a step back and you stop looking at being so frustrated that there's so much plastic moving towards the ocean and obviously harming our marine life, and you look back and you're like, but what is the municipality doing to ensure that waste removal is a priority? What are the municipalities in these communities doing with the funds allocated for waste removal? You know, I am so fortunate to live in Fishhook, in a community where every Thursday there is two trucks that come in and collect recycling waste and your normal waste. So obviously we're not going to have that much of an issue when it comes to if there's some heavy rains and all this water washes out and goes into the ocean, we're not going to have that much litter as we saw recently in KZN. But also at the beaches here in Fishhook, you have the municipality sending in trucks to clean up the beaches after there have been bad storms, sea storms. The kelp is removed, the litter is removed. There's barely any litter on the beaches. Yes, there will be a few plastic bottles, there will be some paper, because humans are humans. But there's so much work being done to remove waste and litter, but you do not see that reflected in rural communities. Yet we start pinpointing and blaming communities for that. So for me, it's just ensuring that we have better channels of including communities and stakeholders in decision-making and planning accordingly. Because most of these issues, again, arise because of lack of access, lack of proper consultation, and then we have environmental degradation. And then what we keep doing is blaming it more on the people rather than the systems built around that should be used to reduce these impacts. And again, I'm going to use the plastic thing. It is very easy for a municipality to, not that it's easy, but it's very simple to put pen to paper and say, hey, as the city of A, B, and C, we would like to ban plastics. You know, even without the consultation of the community, it's so easy to put down laws, especially if you have a reason such as preserving natural resources. So the means are there, the people are there, but we just need better people appointed to run these projects, and we need better stakeholder engagements as well. And then we'll see so many of these environmental issues dying back a little bit. It's a man-made problem in man-made systems, and we as people just need to come together and be more intelligent in how we approach all of these issues.
You made a compelling point to me in an earlier conversation that we had, where you made a link between the importance of maintaining diversity in nature, but also in decision-making. You know, you just touched on that, but would you mind unpacking this a little bit further?
So we know that in a diverse ocean, if there is a sea storm, a tsunami, some oil spill, okay, not an oil spill, because oil spills are so devastating, but if maybe there's some disease outbreak in that space and a certain species dies out, if there's high biodiversity, there will be other species to replace that species' duties in that space. So in a coral reef, for example, if a coral reef is healthy, you'll find your apex predators, which are your sharks and larger fauna, and then you have a lot of zooplankton, phytoplankton, macrofauna that keep the system running. It is healthy, it is thriving, there is a lot happening. There's the big, there's the small, there's the minuscule and tiny. And if, let's say, one of the fish species that are important for building the coral reef, if they die out, there will be other species there to replace its job in that system, because it is very diverse, there's high biodiversity. So if one is removed, there is no failure in that system. The same applies actually in how we make decisions as well. If you only have in a team and in high positions, you only have people who think the same and look at the world the same, there won't be anyone challenging those decisions. There won't be anyone bringing new perspectives and fresh perspectives as well, and asking the important questions, which then leads to these systems failing, which leads to these decisions failing. And I will go back to marine protected areas. When marine protected areas was first implemented in South Africa, we used a very American way of implementing them, and which basically assumed that there were no people who were going to live close to our nature reserves and protected areas. And if there's no people living there, then there's not really much to think about and consider when it comes to consultation of the adjacent communities. So the MPAs were implemented very close to communities, and the communities were restricted. Activities that they have been doing for years and years and years that have been passed down generation and generation were now forbode, and you couldn't do these things close to the MPA, which caused some distress and injustice, social injustice, as well as environmental injustice in these communities. But at that point, had there been someone in the government and environmental department who was a representative of coastal communities and who knew the coastal communities dependent on these resources, and they had traditional knowledge that was passed down generations and generations, they would have advised that proper consultation was done with the community, and that when MPAs were being implemented at that point, they included some form of community-based management efforts. But that was not done, because the vision was to just protect, protect, protect. And there was no one in that group making those decisions who was challenging that. Everyone agreed on that. And that was very detrimental. We see the impacts till this day. You know, I made a film, Kulega, that touches upon this. Communities till this day are struggling with the decision that was made so many years ago I think in 1952, a decision that was made then, communities are still suffering and living the consequences of that decision. So it is important to have more diversity in decision-making. Once again, for the mere reason of ensuring that we can achieve our conservation goals. We cannot be putting so much effort, so much funds, so much labor into protecting natural resources, but fail to meet those goals because we lack diversity in the people and the groups of people that are making those decisions. It is great now to see in this time and age that it's inclusivity and diversity is being considered as an important component, especially in decision making. But it just cannot be. It cannot be ticking a box. You know, diversity, inclusivity is popular now. It's a hot topic. Let's tick this box. We're a progressive organization. We need to save face. That should not be how we approach things. There are so many learned, intelligent individuals who have so much knowledge and so much to share. And it's not a competition. In this space, it's really not a competition because we all, once again, the goal is conservation, ocean conservation, nature conservation. There is no competition in that. It's a goal that needs to be met. And we need to do what's best to ensure that we reach it. And diversity, inclusivity in decision-making is an important component of reaching those goals.
Anyone listening that wants to go and do a little bit more research about Jamila's work, I highly recommend watching Suleka. You can find it on YouTube on the new site, NEWF. But unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up and finishing our discussion. But just to say, if you would like to follow more of Jamila's work, you can find her on Instagram as Xhosa Wanderer, and that's Xhosa Wanderer, WANDERER. So, last question. Given your expertise, what question should I have asked you?
I really enjoyed the questions that you asked me, Olivia. They were well researched and they actually touched upon the work that I am doing and the activism that I have been doing, but also the things that I have learned in the field that I am in now. And yeah, they were very good questions. And thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this entire conversation.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe and leave a review. Let's chat next episode, where I will be asking more creatives and intellectual disruptors about making decisions at the margin. See you next time.